Hello, listeners. My name is Victor Rodriguez, and you're listening to Pulse, where we take a peek at Pierce's unexpectedly layered social environment. Today, I am here with Craig Meyer, environmental science instructor, and one of my favorite professors. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing fine, thanks.
We are going to talk about so many things. We're going to talk about public transportation, population size, what can students do, the cost of freeways, and what is the right thing to do in this spaceship we call Earth. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing fine.
All right. So let's get into this real quick.
Okay.
You teach environmental science here?
Yes, I do.
What do you think is the most important thing that the lay person should understand about the environment?
That this is not a cosmetic issue. The tendency is for people to think that environment's about a view, a good place to take a vacation, a nice camping ground. Our environment is our life support systems. The Earth is a spaceship, okay? And it's no accident that if you go up in a space shuttle, they talk about their environmental systems, generating the oxygen in the atmosphere, maintaining temperature, keeping the humidity, providing water, all the things that our environment has to do for us on spaceship Earth. We get energy from the sun, but the rest of the systems are self-contained. An astronaut would not sell you their atmospheric oxygen-generating system for any amount of money, because it doesn't do any good to have money if you're not around. But we're perfectly happy to do that on Earth, selling off forests and polluting the marine environment and so forth, which for short-term profit compromises those systems. So we need to think a little bit more holistically about the Earth system and realize that our environment is a survival issue. It's not a cosmetic issue.
And you've been at Pierce 43 years.
Yeah.
Do you know the specific date you started here?
No. I think it's 1973. I started here part-time for a while, and then I liked it. So
There's no anniversary we can celebrate?
I don't know. If you get my age, you don't celebrate many anniversaries.
Oof, okay. but what I'm getting at here is you've been here a while, and
yeah.
You no doubt have seen the progress. Do you call it progress even if it's not progressive?
You mean in terms of the school?
In terms of any sort of programs, attempts to help make this campus and the surrounding city more
Well, I'm likely
friendly.
To get myself in trouble here, but I seem to think that from the standpoint of simply academic focus, things were better a while back. It seems that now the district as a whole, but people are more worried about administrative reasons and things like that, political situations, and it's not at all, and it's become more difficult to provide what I would consider to be a comprehensive academic experience.
I think it's what blew my mind when I first came here,
yeah,
is that Pierce does not recycle.
Well, actually, they used to have a recycling program that the ASO offered. But the problem was that it was thwarted by the fact that it is being recycled by regular old people. I have a garbage can outside my office, for example. And if you sit down and watch it, at least five times a day, somebody will come around with a bag, go through it, and collect everything that's recyclable and take it off. So as far as I can see, we have a very effective recycling program because nothing goes unrecycled. But it's a spontaneous upwelling recycling. It's not some kind of program. So the program they put in place was not effective because this stuff was getting recycled out from underneath them. So I would say we do have a recycling program, but it's a spontaneous upwelling of public support.
I think despite the fact that we may not get those precious 5 cents from those bottles and cans, we should still try to recycle paper or plastic as much as we can.
Well, now you're getting to another sticky issue because recycling... Most people think that recycling means that we should turn a product back into what it was. And I don't think that that's really the most efficient way of doing things because it's not necessarily the best thing to do with paper to turn it back into paper. First off, a goodly portion of paper is not recyclable. Paper is made out of cellulose fibers. It's pulp. When you recycle paper, you break the fibers up and repulp it so the quality of the paper is reduced. If the paper has sizing on it, which is the slick coatings on magazines that allow for the ink not to run, or it has color, it can't be recycled because people want white paper. So only a fraction is recyclable back into paper in the first place. The other problem is because of the additional chemical steps you have to do to re- to process recycled paper has a bigger environmental footprint than making it from scratch. You do save some trees, but the trees are coming from tree farms, not from forests. And so I think maybe the best thing to do with paper is to use it for the cellulose and turn it, ferment it into alcohol and use it as a fuel supplement. So our recycling program in the country really needs to be rethought. It's not really a very effective, most of the resources aren't being recycled, right? And I don't know that Pierce, as a single entity, is going to somehow or another get the municipalities and the state and the feds to put the money in to develop a reasonable recycling program, which would start at the dump. That's where the industrial scale levels are. You can't really take waste at home and ferment them in alcohol or to recycle the metals and things like that. So you need to do it in an industrial scale process.
Yes. Yeah. Now, forgive me if I'm getting a little too inside baseball here, but during class you talk about you cannot create or destroy matter
energy. First law of thermodynamics.
So you're thinking we should treat recycling as not trying to make that white paper white again, but more okay, now it's good for this, and slowly gradually down as we find less uses for the newly recycled product.
Well, two things. One, I think we need to look at the waste stream as a resource base, just like metal ore or something like that. It should be mined for its resource value, and we should use it for what we can do with it. We can use paper more effectively as an energy source than simply to write on. Certainly, we should work to get paper down. For example, maybe a decade ago when I looked into some numbers, McDonald's was using 315 square miles of trees to make their paper products for 1 year, that one company, okay? Well, when you go to a company like that and get a hamburger, you don't have to have it wrapped in a piece of paper and that put in a bag and that bag put on a piece of paper on a tray and then three napkins put on there and then you walk 8 feet and then you undo it and throw it all away. You know, they don't do that in Europe, for example. They'll just hand you the hamburger, which is totally fine, and there's no hygiene problem involved with all this wrapping. So the biggest industry, or the bulk of our waste is paper, and most of that comes from packaging and things like that. Office paper is a rather small component. So I think we need to take a look at what kind of resource paper is. It's a cellulosic waste, and we can do an awful lot with it chemically rather than just try to turn it back into paper. It's interesting because one of the motivations behind the computer revolution 20 years ago is that it was going to replace paper, right? And therefore, everything is going to be done digitally. And it turned out to actually produce more paper because people want to back up their stuff with a hard copy because they don't trust the digital thing not to crash. So from the standpoint of a recycling program, well, historically, our recycling program was put in place, as I understand it, by a school teacher from New York who did New York's recycling program. Give you a blue can and a green can and a black can, and people start recycling at home, right? I don't think it works that way because you can only separate out a couple of products, and that doesn't mean they're being recycled anyway. You know, what we need to do is to do, like some countries, Japan and Denmark, are starting to do, and that is going to the dump as a basically a resource base. You look at the dump, man. I'll give you an example. During the Reagan administration, we were having a problem because our supplies of cobalt were threatened. There are two big suppliers of cobalt in the world, the Soviet Union at the time, which is now Russia, and one of the Zambia, I believe it is, in Central Africa. Well, not surprisingly, we weren't getting any cobalt from Russia or the Soviet Union. It's a strategic metal. It's alloyed with iron. It makes ball bearings and hard stuff, particularly strong magnets and so forth. It's a real strategic metal. And we don't have any significant deposits in the United States. A few low-grade deposits in national parks, but they're not worth mining. Okay. Well, it looked like there was going to be a civil war. It was either Zaire or Zambia. It used to be the Belgian Congo, then it became Zambia, now it's the Congo again. But at that time, there was going to be a civil war, it looked like, and the concern was that our supply of cobalt would be cut off. Right. So President Reagan says we're going to have to eliminate all kinds of environmental regulations and go into the national parks and mine the low-grade ores because it's in national security. And sure enough, what happened was that there was a civil war and the supply of cobalt got cut off, right? But unexpectedly, people who didn't need to use cobalt stopped using it because the price went up. People who did use cobalt recognized that we hadn't really been doing any savings. We'd machine it, and all the machines we throw away, and all the cobalt we ever imported is still in the waste stream. You know, it's still here. So we began to go to the waste stream. Within a year, cobalt was never more available on the market than it was before because we went and recognized that there was a resource that we weren't tapping. So I think we need to look at the waste stream in that sense is just like an ore deposit or an energy deposit and mine the resources out of it.
I love that. To sum it up, let's see how far we can go without the things we think we need. I think it's the attitude in this country. You're right. When you go to a fast food place, they give you all these paper wrappers, but in France, you said they just give you the burger.
I mean, look at the pictures of France. People riding down the street on a bicycle with a loaf of bread hanging out of the basket. Right? It's not wrapped in anything. They went to the market and they said, "Here's your bread," and they wrapped it in a little piece of paper and handed it to you. There's no hygiene requirement here. Packaging in the United States is more for advertising. You buy the package. In many products, like cereals and so forth, the package costs more than the product inside. So, it's kind of how we market things more than anything else.
And we can get into the significant markings that advertising has left on the environment, but I want to get into more what regular people can do. I think in mass, small changes can do a little good, not replace things, but
this is the difficulty. In my classes, I can tell you what needs to be done to solve these problems. It's very difficult for me to figure out how to get people to do it. The changes are going to be structural, so they're not going to be. I'm going to stop. I'm going to not buy a new pair of shoes. That helps if everybody does it, but to a minor degree. What we need to do is vote for people that have policies that make common sense. I'll give you an example. In your class, we talked about the laws of thermodynamics, and we point out that anything that uses energy creates entropy, creates an impact, and our environmental problems are the result of all the energy we're using. So the number one focus would be to take steps to reduce the amount of energy that you're using. We looked in the end of ES1, we talk about the kinds of things to improve energy efficiency. The United States is probably the least efficient big economy from the standpoint of energy because we never paid a real price for energy. So one of the things we can do is elect the proper officials who are going to do the courageous things, like let the price of energy rise up to world level so that people are inclined to perceive, and then let the market decide what they're going to do. The city council passed a resolution that by sometime in the 2020s, a certain percentage of the vehicles in Los Angeles had to be pollution-free. There's no such thing as a pollution-free anything. Anything that uses energy creates a certain amount of entropy, but that didn't stop them from voting that nature would have to change the way it's organized to make it convenient for Los Angeles.
Whoa, wait. You're telling me I'm not saving the world by driving a Prius?
No.
What if I throw it out and buy a Tesla?
No. All right, the problem here is that the problem is driving. It's not what you're driving. There's no magical technical fix. A Tesla looks good because it's very efficient, and Tesla, by the way, is the least efficient of the electric vehicles. It looks good because electric motors are very efficient at converting electricity to motive force, to movement. However, the problem is electricity. Electricity is the worst energy bargain. Electric plants are about 35% efficient at converting fossil fuels into electricity. By the time you deliver it to the end user, it's down to around 7% efficient, according to UC Davis's figures. So that the problem is not how efficient the car is at converting electricity, it's how inefficient the generation of electricity is. Are we going to double our electrical generation simply so people can drive electric cars and at the same time have most of it, and which means doubling the amount of fossil fuels? The environmental footprint of the Tesla, when you look at the build-out scenario, the whole life cycle, is about the same as 33 miles a gallon. My truck gets better than that on the freeway if I put a canoe on the top of it. All right. So, and the same thing with a hybrid. If you take a look at the mileage levels for hybrids, it's about 35 to 40 miles a gallon, which is totally accomplishable with a small piston car that's streamlined. In fact, Caltech and MIT used to have a competition between their automotive engineering departments. They would build the most energy efficient vehicle and they'd drive across country from you know, one school to the other, and the one that got the best mileage would win some trophy, right? They were getting 1,000 miles a gallon, right? Volkswagen has a car out, a concept car, gets 200 miles a gallon. Opel has a car running on the Grand Prix circuit that gets 113 miles a gallon. So a 100-mile-a-gallon car, piston car, using present technology is entirely doable. If you give me a battery car, now we got a problem of where we're going to get all the materials for the batteries, where we're going to do dispose of the batteries, which are a particularly big hazard problem. And the batteries, people seem to fit. You get a hybrid, or a Tesla, let's say, and replacing the batteries after a couple of years is going to cost you $7,000-$8,000, you know, which is more than my truck cost. So when you look at the whole picture, it doesn't really make some sense. But people are looking for a technical fix to prevent us from having to change anything. People are afraid of change. Psychologists tell us that change is scarier, the scariest thing. So people are hoping there's a technical way to prevent them from having to change the way they're doing things.
All right. Let's shift from what we drive to what we drive on.
Okay.
I know Los Angeles is very famous for movies, for a lot of stuff, but one of the big things we're famous for is our traffic.
Yeah. Well, we started the problem with traffic because we're an open space. We got lots of, you know, we're a spread out city. I mean, there's 100 miles. You can go 100 miles in any direction and still be within the city in some places. And so starting back after the Second World War, the automobile became the chosen mode of transport. And the city council and so forth thought that they had to make it automobile friendly because that was the coming trend. Right? But as soon as we started having automobiles, we began to have traffic problems. And the general consensus, when you ask most people, I take a poll in my class what people think, and people think that the solution to the traffic problem is building more roads. You know, if traffic is jammed, then we need to have additional freeways or more lanes on the freeway. So starting out with the Pasadena Freeway, I think in 1947, we built that to facilitate traffic going into L.A. And did traffic get better? No, it got worse. So then we decided we better build the Santa Ana Freeway. Okay, so we built that in the 1950s. And did traffic get better? No, it got worse. So then we decided we had to have a Santa Monica Freeway. So we built that. Traffic got worse still. In fact, every time we go through a cycle of traffic building, the traffic gets worse. And the simple fact is that that's because the idea that building more roads is a solution is backwards. Network theory, the mathematical modeling of networks and so forth, points out that that's not a possible solution. And the simple fact is that you can't build roads as fast as people can buy cars to use them. Right? Several years ago, I checked with Caltrans, and the cost of a mile of freeway in Los Angeles is $125 million a mile. Okay.
A mile?
Yeah. So 10 miles, $1.2 billion. So what happens? Well, you build a freeway. The construction companies like it. The people like it because they think that's the solution. But the problem is they're thinking that the problem is that there's not enough roads for the cars when traffic is the result of too many cars for the roads. So the solution to traffic is reducing the number of vehicles, not increasing the number of roads. You can't possibly increase the number of roads faster than people can buy vehicles. Secondly, a traffic system or a freeway system is a network. And if you look at the mathematics of network theory, you realize that the more complex the network, the more connections you have, the slower the flow through it. Right? Simple fact is you can't build a freeway that doesn't have to connect to all the off-ramps and to all the other freeways, and each one of those junctures is a choke point. Right? So the perfect freeway would have no connections. It would just go from point A to point B, a straight line, and you just got on and got off, and that was it. But that's not the way freeway systems work. So the more freeways you built, the more complex the network, and the less direct traffic flows through it. So the trick is, if you're going to treat it with traffic, is to realize that the solution is to reduce the vehicles to what the freeways can accommodate. And if you're always building freeways, by the way, then that's holding up traffic too, because you're never having a clear flow anyway. So my thinking, and again, there are other people that think differently perhaps, but I'm convinced that people will do what's easiest for them. And consequently, if you want to get a change, you design the right thing to do to be the easiest thing to do. So my theory is don't build any more freeways. Don't say you can't drive them, but provide a more attractive option so that people, when they get tired of trying to hassle the freeway, will have a better way of doing things. And the better way of doing things is a rapid transit system. Now, let me make it clear that we don't have one in Los Angeles. So do not assume that any experience you had getting on the bus or riding on this line or that line is a rapid transit system. A rapid transit system has to be faster than driving, cheaper than driving, safer than driving. It has to get you within 2 blocks of anywhere you are to within 2 blocks of anywhere you want to go. And it has to be, what else is left? Well, anyway, it has to be all those things, okay? Where those exist, people use them. Throughout most of the industrialized world, people use rapid transit, and a car is not even necessary, right? Best system I came across was when I grew up in New Orleans, and strangely enough, they have one of the best rapid transit systems that I've encountered. When I was a kid, the buses ran every 10 minutes, so you're never more than 5 minutes away from getting a bus. That's the last thing I forgot to say. You have to run regularly. You can't be sitting on a bus stop for 2 hours till your bus comes along, all right? They go everywhere you want to go. You can get on a bus within 2 blocks of your house, and you can get to within 2 blocks of anywhere in the city. The cost was 7 cents. The city of New Orleans recognized that the rapid transit system was a public service. It was part of New Orleans public service. And therefore, it wasn't designed to be a profit-making venture. It was designed to use the profits that were generated from water and power to amortize transportation costs. Everybody used it. It's safe because the buses were always being used. Nobody in their right mind would drive down New Orleans because it's such a crammed in by the river. A two-lane street would be the size of my classroom. People go to formal affairs in tuxedos and ball gowns on the bus with no stigma. So I think you'd say drive the freeways if you want. Use your car for discretionary purposes. But go to work on rapid transit. If everybody went to work without driving their cars, we wouldn't have to import any oil. So there's lots of solutions here that we could look at.
All right. And it's funny enough you mentioned your classroom. I wanted to touch on this a little bit.
Okay.
And you are currently located in the Village.
Yeah.
That is a hop, skip, and a long trek away from anywhere on the main campus.
Yeah.
Why aren't you in the brand spanking relatively new Center for Sciences building?
Again, I'm going to get myself in trouble here, but I don't think the building, I don't like the way it was designed. I don't think it was congruent to my ideas of how I wanted to teach. Bob Garber was president at that time, and he seemed to have some appreciation for our program, and it wasn't going to be served well by that building. So I told him I didn't want to move into that one, and I had no input on it. And he said, okay, fine. They put me over here as a temporary situation, and we're going to move into the new Earth Sciences building that used to be the Ag building that's been redesigned, and we had input on redesigning it so it's going to fit geology, oceanography, and environmental sciences needs. So it worked out best, but I'd rather be over here than in a non-functional situation. I don't like that building.
So you practice what you preach.
I would hope.
Okay, now let's talk about voting. And you said that it's we should vote for people who make policies that are the right thing to do, that make laws that are beneficial for everyone, including the future, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why can't we seem to find any?
Well, I think the problem lies in this. If you're going to go back to the theory of self-government, it's a very difficult task to be a citizen in a representative government situation. It implies the need to become well enough informed to have a good opinion. The problem we have in the United States is that the general public is not well enough informed to have a good opinion. And I can understand that. I get paid to stay up. I can put in 3 hours a day to keep up with what's going on in my field and so forth. But I'm thinking about what a guy who's working at a boiler maker at a boiler factory. He works all day at a steam fitter, and he comes home, he's tired, he puts his feet up, watches half an hour of local news on Channel 5 or whatever, eats dinner, drinks a beer, and goes to bed. How's he going to put in the time necessary to become well enough informed and well enough educated to be able to make decisions on scientific issues and issues of that type? I mean, we've got a president who doesn't understand global warming when there's absolutely no confusion about it. There's no controversy about it in any of the scientific fields. Anybody who's had a minimum amount of science understands that. But how do we get a public that's well enough educated to make their own decisions? Right now, people get elected, but if they have the right charisma, and the average voter is looking for somebody that tells them what they want to hear, and that's who they'll vote for. Right now, I think, this is my own opinion on this one, but I think our elected our representative system is in crisis. It doesn't work if the electorate doesn't make it work. Okay, I'm also impressed by the or depressed, however you want to take it, by the fact that when you look back in history, there's not been a government of the people that lasted more than a couple hundred years. Right, I think it might well be that it requires more responsibility from the general electorate than people are capable of producing. Anyway, the decisions that we make now are based on popularity rather than rationality. I'm hoping, though, the students that I'm getting in classes like yours now seem to be a little bit more concerned and understanding what's going on and not making the same mistakes. In the 60s, we had people that were fairly well informed that made some changes in civil rights and so forth. Then the millennials came in, and somehow or another, they were focused on something else. And now I think that this new generation now is becoming more focused on doing some things and issues. And they're going to hold our politicians to a little bit higher standards.
Well, I've always wondered, I forgot who it was that said, or that was the modern career politician. I think it was Reagan.
Well, all politicians now are modern career politicians.
Yes. Why do we keep seeing these? Why don't scientists run if they have all the answers?
They don't get elected.
Because they don't have a charisma? Huh? I think you have a lot of charisma for scientists.
All right. Well, if I thank you for that, though. I'm not so sure how. At any rate, there were people that challenged that. But say that I was. The last thing in the world I want to do is be a politician. You know, I've got better things in my life to do, and I don't like people that much. So it takes a certain amount of mindset to want to be a politician. I think the transition happened during the Andrew Jackson administration. The founding people in our country basically looked at politics as a civic responsibility like jury duty. You serve your time in office, you make your commitments, and then you go on and lead a productive life. Washington was that way. The Cincinnatian wasn't a myth, Cincinnati story, where the general won the war and then he went back to running his farm, and that's exactly what Washington said. I've had enough, I've done my share, now I'm going back to be a good citizen. Career politicians started to come in, I think, during the Jackson administration, at least as I understand it and read history, and that's different. When you're not looking to get reelected, you can make the tough decisions that may not be popular but are the right things to do. You can lead. When you're looking to get reelected, then your skill stops being in leading and starts being in how to get elected. And the way you do that is to tell people what they want to hear. And when you do that, you're not going to get the kinds of decisions that are unpopular but necessary. So I think we're in that state now where politicians to get elected will basically do whatever they got to do.
It seems to me like the people who want these positions shouldn't have it. And the people who so dread them, who know what to do, should maybe have responsibility thrust upon them.
I'm with you 100%. I always thought that one of the criteria for being president is anybody who wants a job should be disqualified. If you're going to do it right, it's not going to be fun. It's not going to be comfortable. You're not going to play golf every day. And I agree with you.
All right. Well, that about wraps up our show here. I sat down today with Professor Craig Meyer. My name is Victor Rodriguez. You've been listening to Pulse, where we take a peek at Pierce's unexpectedly layered social environment for kpcradio.com.